From a Swiss point of view, should I say? Yes?
Yeah.
European point of view, that's international. With Adriana Nadja Rodriguez and Jaime Pinheiro.
Good morning. I am pleased to present you today what we found recently at ETH Zurich on chemical ecology of the oriental fruit moth, a worm-adapted fructivorous species. I thank the organizers warmly for inviting me to this symposium. When I received the invitation letter for a short presentation at this symposium, I asked back whether a presentation on the oriental fruit moth would be considered convenient, because the geographic distribution range of this pest is no longer confined to the subtropics. The answer came back immediately, yes, go on, this suits very well or fits very well into a symposium of the international branch. The oriental fruit moth has an interesting name. It is a fruit moth, a destructive species, a herb, destructive herbivore requiring intense pest management input on its primary host, which is peach, and on its other rosaceae fruit tree hosts. This is the damage often inflicted by the first generation to twigs, and this is the damage inflicted by later generations of the up to 6 to 7 generations per year to fruit. It is an oriental fruit moth, particularly well adapted to warm temperatures. When given a choice along a wide temperature range, the females prefer to oviposit at a temperature around 30 degrees. And this temperature is also optimal for offspring performance. This is an exemplary, an ideal example in support of the optimal oviposition theory. In this species, apparently mother knows best where to deposit the eggs in order to avoid too warm temperatures that would be lethal to the progeny. Northwestern China is considered the origin of this species. And this is where this picture comes from. It has been taken by Maohua Chen, with whom I could establish a collaboration this summer. He is now a professor at Northwest A&F University. Northwestern China is situated far south, around 34 degree latitude. And this is as south, far south as the Middle East or North Africa. The species became a major fruit pest, meanwhile, through the subtropics and beyond, including the southern islands of Japan, where the type specimens for its first description, only in 1916, have been collected. During the only last 100 years, this species made it to Australia, to the Middle East, to North Africa, to Brazil, and to many other countries. Trade contributed to this spread, as we could show recently in a population genetic study. The species is now also recorded in areas of higher latitude. In the region where I live, around my university, which is situated at a latitude of 47 degrees, its occurrence is still erratic, so we cannot yet make field trials. Stimulated by colleagues from the south, I decided to contribute to a better understanding of this herbivore's interaction with the plant mediated by plant chemicals. In particular, I will start with plant volatiles to which approaching females ready to oviposit are exposed. Then I will address non-volatile plant chemicals to which feeding larvae are exposed. I could add this second part to my talk after the organizers generally expanded the time slots for the speakers. So I start with plant volatiles. Relatively little is known on the female gender in this species, although females have the capacity to move between non-contiguous orchards, and gravid females seem to be the main colonists of new habitats. However, current monitoring still relies mainly on stimuli, attracting males only on sex pheromones. So my principal question was, how do host volatiles mediate attraction of mated females? Understanding of key processes relevant for female attraction might provide useful baseline data for future monitoring of females. Olfactory biases with plant material from trees showed that peach volatiles are highly attractive to oriental fruit moths. And I focus here on volatiles from the primary host peach. We made volatile collections using a dynamic headspace sampling system and analyzed the volatiles with coupled gas chromatography mass spectrometry. Ubiquitous green leaf volatiles accounted for more than 50% of the total volatiles collected. Among the other chemical classes, we had major and minor components. For example, among the aromatics, we had benzaldehyde as a major component and benzonitrile as a minor component available only in a 100-fold lower concentration in the blend. So we decided, or we guessed, that the identified compounds in the headspace of the host likely contain some redundant information for the attracted moths. But what is the essential information? There are two clearly contrasting approaches. We can test compounds singly, bottom-up, or we can simplify natural blends top-down in a stepwise manner. We can focus on major components, or we can also include minor components. This is actually where I could start a project with my previous postdoc, Jaime Pinheiro, who laid the decisive basis for all the subsequent points. We decided to take the approach here shown at the right, to start top-down and not to neglect minor constituents. We made olfactometry to assess the female's behavior. So we gave the females a choice between odors, host-derived synthetic odors, and a control, which is here a solvent control, hexane control. And we inserted the female here into the central arm, so it had to make a choice between odor treatment or control. We simplified the mixture in a stepwise manner, top-down to five compounds, while maintaining its bioactivity, its attraction. Further, deleting more compounds always led to a loss of bioactivity. However, this five-compound mixture here was still as attractive as the natural blend. This five-compound mixture was composed of three green leaf volatiles, derivatives of C6 alkenes, and two aromatics, benzaldehyde and benzonitrile, which accounted only for 0.15% in the total volatile blend. However, when we deleted benzonitrile, which we term here B, from the total blend, attraction was lost, as was the case when we tested only the remaining four compounds, which we term here M. This is a synopsis of the approach taken and the behavioral assays made. After identification of the complex volatile blend, we simplified the mixture in a stepwise manner down to 5 compounds. Further deletion of single compounds or of groups of compounds always led to a loss of bioactivity. For example, constituent M, which comprises 4 compounds, were inactive when tested alone, as was the remaining constituent B, benzonitrile. It was also inactive when tested alone. Their combination, so a combination of 2 single constituents that have no effect alone, was highly attractive to the moth. Thus, M and B act in concert in a truly synergistic manner. To better understand this synergism, we decided to look into the insect's brain. The first center processing the olfactory cues received by the antennae are the antennal lobes. So we used, in order to quantify the odor-evoked activation in the antennal lobes, we used functional imaging, which is a technique based on calcium-sensitive dye. This shows the glomerular activation in the antennal lobes of the female. The single constituents M and B were perceived qualitatively differently from their combination. In fact, an arithmetic approach would yield the following if we had a mere additive effect. A response of the to the combination minus response to constituent B, M, should yield constituent B, but this was not the case. The calculated response after this subtraction yielded this picture, which is stronger quantitatively and qualitatively more complex than the real measured response to constituent B. This is the verification that we have here much more than a simple additive effect. The effect is fully synergistic. Now we have here an interesting basis for addressing changing ratios of constituents. Exclusively the blend comprising both other constituents, M and B, conveys the essential message to the female moths. It is now known that even a minor host gland odor constituent like B can be very important. But in the field, evaporation of single compounds cannot be expected to be uniform, so ratios between constituents may change. Our question was, how do females cope with changing ratios of blend constituents? We manipulated just the ratio of M to B of these defined constituents. We kept M constant and used for B the natural concentration or lower and higher concentrations. This shows the percentage of females preferring the resulting blend over the control in the olfactometer trial. We had a marked dose response. The combination with the natural concentration of constituent B was highly attractant, as was the combination which increased the constituent B by 2 orders of magnitude. Hence, there is a considerably robust female behavior to changing ratios of constituents. We also looked into the insect's brain and studied the neurophysiological activation, the glomerular activity in the antennal lobes. And again here, we had a marked dose response and a significant activation at the natural ratio of the blends, quite expectedly, but also when we increased the second constituent by a factor of 100. So the female behavior is directly paralleled by this neurophysiological effect. What can we now conclude regarding the top-down approach and the ratios? Focusing on mated females of an oligophagous species, which is known to feed on related fruit tree species, we studied the responses to host volatiles. The labor-intensive top-down approach was quite useful, as we detected synergistically active acting constituents which we would have missed making a bottom-up approach. The minor constituents were also useful to be included, as we have shown that they may play a significant role in the interaction between plant and herbivore. As for the variable ratios, we found a considerable plasticity in response of the female. This finding is likely of significance beyond the species tested, beyond the oriental fruit moths. In fact, in a most recent study by Dong Chang, co-authors from Cornell, they reported for a specialist herbivore, the grapery moths, that they can modulate the ratios of the essential compounds in the blend and still get attraction. We have now received an insight into the female's behavior in the interaction with plant volatiles. But what about the fate of their larvae while feeding on the plant? To understand the context of this question better, we have to consider the distribution ranges again. Distribution ranges of herbivores depend on their requirements regarding abiotic and biotic environments. In Europe, the oriental fruit moth is mainly distributed south of the Alps, in areas characterized by warm summer temperatures around 30 degrees. In contrast, the closely related codling moth, the tortoise species as well, is distributed up to Sweden. It tolerates far cooler temperatures. Now, currently, concomitantly with climate change, the oriental fruit moth is expanding its distribution range north of the Alps, for example, in the especially hot summer of 2003, we recorded for the first time oriental fruit moth females in my region. Such range expansion is often associated with a host shift. Peach, for example, is quite scarcely planted in northern areas, whereas apple, that is accepted together with other palm fruit species as a secondary host by the oriental fruit moth, is abundant. But what about walnut? The related codling moth includes this plant from the family of Juglandaceae into its diet. Both moth species belong to the same tribe, Graphelidini, and their larvae are internal fruit feeders. Despite these similarities, the oriental fruit moth has never been recorded to feed on walnut. So our question was, is range expansion of the oriental fruit moth to Juglandaceae hosts excluded due to toxic plant metabolites? Plant secondary metabolites often limit range expansion of herbivores. The green husk of walnut surrounding the growing brown nut contains toxic naphthoquinones, among which juglone prevails. Juglone is stored mainly in the non-toxic glucosidic form in the plant tissue, and it is released upon herbivory. It is toxic to many, many herbivore species, with quite few exceptions only, including the codling moths. We have shown earlier this year that the codling moths can feed on a diet supplemented with juglone, and it obviously can cope with this situation. So So we hypothesize that this will not be the case for the oriental fruit moths. We carried out bioassays on diet supplemented with juglone, and completely to our surprise, the oriental fruit moth could survive on a diet containing natural levels of juglone. This shows the percentage of individuals reaching the pupal stage in white or the adult stage in red. And at the low level of the natural juglone in walnut husk, the survival was as high as in the control devoid of any juglone. At the high natural level of juglone, survival still amounted to more than 50%. Only when we doubled the maximum concentration found in nature, then the effect was lethal. In total, this pattern was quite similar to the pattern which we had found for the codling moths earlier this year, meaning that the oriental fruit moth tolerates a defensive compound from a non-host plant. So we wondered, what is the fate of juglone in the larva of the oriental fruit moth? We carried out chemical analysis and found 1,4,5-trihydroxynaphthalene, which is the non-toxic reduced form in the larval frass, as well as in larvae fed on juglone diet, so with their guts filled with juglone diet. This result is again quite similar to what we found previously with the codling moth. So juglone is apparently metabolized in the intestinal system of the moth. Juglone itself was not found in the larval hemolymph or in starved larvae with their guts emptied or in subsequent life stages. So this in vivo reduction this absence here indicates that juglone is not sequestered by the oriental fruit moth. And this result again resembles that which we found earlier this year for the codling moth quite strongly. So in vivo reduction apparently led to juglone detoxification in the oriental fruit moth. It has the effective tools to cope with a secondary metabolite which it doesn't encounter in its diet. So these are the conclusions on the oriental fruit moth and the host range. Some herbivores widen not only their geographic area but concomitantly their host range. For example, the European corn borer, which is a native European pest feeding on wild plants, could survive and thrive well on maize, which has been introduced from Central America to Europe, despite quite a number of toxic compounds in maize, including the toxic acid Dimboa. Likewise, for the oriental fruit moth, apple was initially reported as a secondary, relatively unimportant host. But now it is of continuously increasing significance on many continents of the world. It has been reported from China, it has been reported from Europe, it has been also reported from Brazil and from North America. So, and this indicates that the pest's potential is here to adapt to new host. Provided other factors are favorable, it cannot be excluded that this moth might expand its host range in future, including also plants of the family of Juglandaceae. To summarize my contribution to this symposium of the international branch, we have seen that the oriental fruit moths originate from an area with high summer temperatures, from Southeast Asia, and then became distributed throughout the subtropics, and is currently expanding its distribution range concomitantly with climate warming. we gained an insight into female response to host plant volatiles. The top-down approach revealed true synergism. We also found that females have a relatively high behavioral plasticity regarding ratio specificity of single constituents in the essential blend. The oriental fruit moss is invasive in many countries and on all fruit-growing continents. It can detoxify the main defense compound of juglandaceae plants, and this suggests that it may expand its host range in future under certain conditions. So the oriental fruit moss is a global invader. It has surrounded the world within 100 years, and it has yet unexpected potential to become even a more dangerous invader. Thank you.
Thank you, Sylvia. We have time for questions. Yes.
Okay. Yeah.
Please repeat the question.
Okay. So the question was how we made the top-down approach, because that's not so trivial. Why to delete single compounds and how to determine the original ratio. So my co-author Jaime Pinheiro is also present here, and I will give now an answer. And if it's not sufficient, he may continue. So it is certainly not trivial to delete compounds, and it was made in an intuitive manner. So you have seen we have 50%, more than 50% green leaf volatiles in the blend. And green leaf volatiles certainly indicate damaged tissue. And some of these C6 compounds may contain redundant information, you know, hexanal, so related compounds. So we started to reduce there. And we grouped the compounds, and it was certainly also a trial and error manner. So around 7-8 compounds, we had some problems because all of a sudden we lost bioactivity. And the point was that we deleted benzonitrile, this constituent B. And then attraction was gone. So we realized we are now going to a dead end. So we went back to 8 and made different changes. And down to 5, actually, it was our original goal to come down to about 4 to 6. That was our dream, and with 5 we were blocked. We could not delete anything else. So this is how we did it, and we had just in the volatile collection, we had the proportions of the compounds which we measured. We had quantified the original blend using 15 parallel samples. And then we just tried to mimic again the original blend or the essential components of the original blend by using similar ratios. It has been published, so the details can be looked up.
Other questions? Greg, sorry.
That is an important step. So the question was, after landing and while feeding, obviously the oriental fruit moss can tolerate the walnut constituents. But what about before landing, the volatiles? How do volatiles fit in total? We know that there are overlapping volatiles between primary and secondary hosts, so peach and apple and walnut. On the other end, we do not yet know whether this is sufficient to attract then the oriental fruit moth to walnut. There may be several steps in host location and acceptance which are not yet overcome by oriental fruit moth populations. And finally, we are not 100% sure whether no oriental fruit moths are in Juglandaseen hosts, because they may be confounded with codling moths. And if we do not have very selective methods of control, then we may just use a compound, a spray, which is also lethal to the oriental fruit moth. So I'm just really very curious about the first note of an infestation by this species on a Juglandaseen host.
We have a question there, and then Steve.
Perhaps along the same line, but of course, oriental fruit moth and large areas of pollen production have overlapped for a number of decades in California. Do you think the fact that oriental fruit moth there has apparently not yet made that leap is because climatic effects just give evolution more time once you're on that?
I'm not sure whether I acoustically heard everything, so you may correct it. Sorry.
Okay, basically the question, the observation was, do have walnuts and oriental fruit moths overlapping in California? And the question was, what are your thoughts on why we have not yet seen that leap? If it's just not sufficient evolutionary time, or if there are climatic factors involved?
I think it could several points or several aspects could be involved. So what I mentioned as a reply to the previous question, that not all steps in the host location process are optimal for the oriental fruit moth while approaching walnut. The other point is that the population of the oriental fruit moth may contain individuals with different abilities for odor perception. I will give a presentation in the volatile chemical symposium this afternoon, just the first presentation on that. So the perception of the females vary. It's not uniform. And we are about to study this effect, and it looks like that such deviating perception may be linked to fecundity, and that somewhat the pioneer individuals have lower number of progeny. But we are just in progress with this work. So it may take some time to have a population, a larger sizable population, which is adapted.
All right. Thank you very much. Oh, Steve, sorry.
Quick question. What do we know about the host models of wild peaches and the relative other prunus species, maybe perhaps even in Central Asia, both the specifics and the quantity of those host models produced by the wild
So the question is, what do we know about the volatiles produced by wild peach species, so in Southeast Asia? In total, we know quite few things about volatiles from peach. We published our first paper in 2003 on that, and previous papers only found, I think, two or three volatiles in total. So methodology just for identification has improved strongly. And that's all we know up to now. We know nothing, and these experiments has been done with cultivated peach. We do know very little, in fact, about the oriental fruit moths in China. There are a number of papers published by in Acta Sinica, so in Chinese papers, but now Northwest A&F University is st- strongly interested in that point, and with this collaboration we hope just to promote general knowledge on important aspects which can be primarily gained in the region of origin of prunus, of course, and of the oriental fruitmus.
Thank you very much. Thank you. Thank you.